Okay. So, let's say some more about that. So, to try to kind of bring our points together. So, we know that the question of Das and Kiddushin has a couple of elements to it. And we've seen that there is a requirement for Das. That is one thing that is clear from the very brief reference in our daf, Beis and Beis. But beyond that, there's a lot to wonder about. There's a lot to wonder what exactly does Das mean? What kind of Das is it? What is it that is bringing about the Das? And to what extent does it cut both ways? To what extent is it about the Ish and the Isha together? So to try to kind of see all this into one context. So we've seen already that when it comes to the Isha, so we know the Gemara says it requires Das, and the Rashba asks, well, yeah, I mean, what else would you think? I mean, clearly you always need Das for Hakna, you always need a Das Makna, so why would I even think that here that's not the case? So the Rashba should mention actually has different answers to this, because the Rashba on our daf, in Kedushin Beis Mekeis, so the Rashba says it's because you could get thrown by the fact that it's a discussion in the Marga of Basra by Tzlu V'Zavin. However, interestingly, and just also to connect this again to the previous sugya of Kedushin by Karga, the Rashba Gittin on daf Ayin Hey, the Rashba says you need to be told that you need Das for Kedushin, because we could have thought that this is part of the limud of that same limud that we don't know the whole scope of, the Yotza Mahaisa. Right? So the question is, to what extent are we connecting Gittin and Kedushin? So our previous sugya raised the question of, does it mean that just like a get can't be with Karka, so too a Kedushin of any kind can't be with Karka? But it also brings up the question, maybe we should say that since a get min haTorah can be given bal korcho, so too maybe kedushin can happen bal korcho. Maybe we got to the of both directions. So therefore we need to be told that even though it otherwise seems logical, we still need to have it confirmed for us that we need das ha'isha by kedushin. So we noted already that Rashi is considered to contradict himself by those who point to him, in the fact that in Yevamos he says it's the halcha v'haisa lish, that sounds like it has to be midas, while later on in Kedushin, daf mandalid, he says simply das makna, and raises the question, well, is it something we can understand logically from the need for das by hakna? Or is it something that is miyucha to kedushin that comes from the yotza v'halcha v'haisa? So that prompts the question in general: is this a specific kedushin din, or is it a general kinyana point? Now, you guys saw the smag. The smag is on the list. Sorry. Right, but you could tell, I guess, I hope you could tell, or I would have helped, maybe I should have been more helpful. But the smog, you could tell which parts are most relevant, because he does go right into this. If you cut through the smog, you can see that he talks about, and you don't get too smug about it, you can see that he talks about the source for the halacha of Das Kedushin, right? And he basically says, like Rashi. Right, essentially like Rashi, to clarify, like Rashi and Yevamos, and it's a drush of the halcha v'haisa. So there he expands in a very interesting way, and he addresses the implicit question of how do we put Bava Basra and that drusha together. That here, on the one hand, Bava Basra doesn't seem like it's talking really about anything specific to Kedushin. Seems like it's applying straight Kinyanim rules to Kedushin. And Rashi Nivamba sounds like there is a specific Kedushin din. So what does the Smag say to that? Right, did you see this? The Smag basically sees the Gemara and Bava Basra as only talking about the guy. that when it comes to the Isha, so we know for sure that there's no discussion to be had. If she doesn't have das, the kedushin can't work, and therefore if somebody forces her to get married, that's not going to happen. So the Gemara has a whole discussion about how, well, on the one hand, two of the zavid, zvini, zvini, so you can force people to enter into a transaction because at the end of the day, they reconcile to it because they get the kesef. So what's the story with Isha? So that's my focus in the Gemara, right? So according to one opinion, it seems like it works. And according to the second opinion, no, it doesn't work, but apparently because of Afkeinu, because the Rabbanan came in and canceled it out, because who else says Shalom Kehogan, we're going to do to him Shalom Kehogan. So the simple reading of the Gemara, the way we've related to it till now, is that this is talking about a man forcing a woman to marry him. And that it could have worked as far as Dina Kinyanim were concerned, but Chazal negated it. Chazal undid the marriage. So the Smag has a very different understanding of it, which conceptually works well, although it forces us to really read the Gemara. And then if you look around, there's some of those like Kelim and Shulchan Aruch and others who address the Smag, you see how they try to fit the Gemara into it, because he has to kind of really read the Gemara differently. But according to the Smag, there's no real possibility of forcing a woman into Kedushin. That's not even something that conceptually could have worked. Why? Because he says, like Rashi Nivomish, the Pasuk Nivomish, there's no such thing as Kedushin for Nisha Balkar. So when the Gemara had that whole discussion about Tzulu V'Zavin and Afkeinu, that's talking about the man. That if the man is forced to marry a woman, then it could have worked. But Chazal, according to the second opinion, Chazal were mafkiya. You follow? You look a little perplexed.
It's
not simple reading the Gemara, right? So everyone, certainly if you read the Rashbam, it sounds like from Tosfos, if you read the way we've been discussing the Gemara and the way most of the Rishonim, that's not what the Gemara sounds like. But if you again look at some of those that Kalim and Shulchan Aruch, you could look, for example, Rav Gustman talks about this in the Shirim, he quotes men who point you how to read the Gemara differently. Again, it involves effort, but how you could reread the Gemara, that who osa shalom kehogan is not talking about the husband who's forcing the woman to marry him, it's talking about this third mysterious guy who's there punching the husband and forcing him to marry this woman. So we undo what he did. We don't give him the satisfaction of knowing that his pressure has paid off, and we undo the marriage. But the case that's going on is it's a man being forced to marry a woman. Again, clearly not the Pashuk Shnei Gemara, but on a conceptual level, it works better a little bit for us. And again, this is not the Nechronish Shnei, this is the Smag. That essentially, when it comes to the Isha, there's nothing to talk about. The essence of Kedushin would never have made this even a possibility. And the only possibility is in terms of forcing the man, and that's where the Gemara has the discussion of whether or not we apply Afkeinu. So the Daya, did you have a hand up?
Would you go and repeat the Smag?
Yeah, the Smag basically is making at least two important points, which are related. One is that he says, and a little bit more clearly, like Rashi and Yavamas, that it's a drasha and a pasuk, why there's no Kedushin Bakarcha, why Kedushin means das. Okay, that's step one. Now, to fill it in also, you see that if that's an inherent requirement in Kedushin, that it needs das, so the whole sugya in Bava Basra is difficult to read, because the sugya in Bava Basra doesn't sound like it's talking about anything specific to Kedushin. Sounds like we can just fit it into a formula of Kinyana. And it also sounds like from the Gemara in Kedushin, I'm still the Gemara in Bava Basra, that it could have worked, but Chazal said Afkeinu, that they made it not work because it's not nice. Right? So how does that work with the idea that there is a specific limud in Kedushin? None of that seems to play out in the Gemara in Bava Basra. So in the Smag's reading, the Gemara in Bava Basra is not talking about any of that. The Gemara in Bava Basra is not talking about forcing a woman to marry. It's talking about forcing a man to marry some other woman. some mysterious third party here is coming in and forcing this man to marry a woman. And in that case, that follows Dini Kinyanim, and therefore maybe there was a svara that should work, but practically speaking, that's where Afkenu comes in. And again, you have to really reread the Gemara against the way the Rishonim on the Daf read it. You have to see against the way the words probably would have sounded like even without the Rishonim. But that's how the Smaug understands it. And again, conceptually, it's a neater package. Conceptually, it flows nicely. Okay? So far, so good. So, on the other hand, those who don't read it like that, so then the question is, so how does the Gemara apply to a man? And does it apply to a man, right? So if you read the Gemara like most of the Rishonim on the Daf in the Lubasra, that is talking about a woman who's being forced, so then what's the story with a man? Is it possible to force a man to marry a woman? And if it's possible, then the next question is, should we still say that nonetheless this Hafkah applies to him as well? So maybe we'll do that second question first, because it's a little more straightforward. So some understand that if there's any distinction to be made between a woman and a man in this situation, but if a woman is forced into the marriage, we're mafkia the kedushin, because it's not nice. But if a man is forced into the marriage, we're not mafkia the kedushin. So why aren't we worried about him? Sorry?
You divorce her.
Say it again?
Because he can divorce her.
He can divorce her, right? Because the assumption is that in HaTorah, he can divorce her and he can get out of it, and she doesn't have that option. So therefore, we're not going to force her into a situation or allow her to remain in a situation where she didn't come in her free will to begin with. And the man doesn't have the same problem. So what does the Taz ask about that? Well, so nowadays, not true anymore. Right, nowadays, practically speaking, we have a Cherim Derabbeinu Gershom, which means a couple things. Cherim Derabbeinu Gershom, just for background, Rabbeinu Gershom is associated with a number of Tikkun Olam-oriented institutions, just to say a word about this, because it's coming up here. And Cherim Derabbeinu Gershom, in the context of Kedushin, means two complementary institutions. One, they really need each other. One is that a man may not marry more than one wife, even though min haTorah he can. And also that he's not allowed to divorce his wife, bal kocha. And those two go together, because let's say you have a man who doesn't want to give his wife a get, so he could theoretically just marry somebody else. So here he stopped from doing that because that's no longer an option, thanks to Chaim Derabbeinu Gershom. But also, the question of if he just decides that he's not interested in her and wants to get rid of her without her consent, so he can neither just take another wife and ignore her, nor divorce her without her will, without her consent. The Chaim Derabbeinu Gershom addresses both ends. And just parenthetically, Cherem Derabbeinu Gershom, so it's a big machlokus in general, what it means when you see a cherem of anybody, a cherem Derabbeinu Gershom, a cherem HaKadmonim, a cherem in general. Does that mean that something was mutter before, and whichever rabbinic authority at that time came and created a new iser? Or does it mean that no, this is not something that was mutter before? We shouldn't infer from the fact that we refer to a cherem as if to say that until now it was mutter. Maybe it was always asur, it was always wrong, but it was something that people were mezalzel in, something that people were not treating with proper seriousness, so the rabbinic authorities of that time had to come in and make a major policy in order to ensure that people would behave properly. So that's a major discussion, there's a lot to say about it. But here, for example, just on this one case of being Begari Shanisha Bal Korcha, so Rav Shechter and others have often maintained that it was always wrong to be Begari Shanisha Bal Korcha. It's just possible in HaTorah to do, but it was never right. but people were doing it, and Rabbeinu Gershom came and said, I'm officially formalizing our extreme disdain towards somebody who would do this. So Taz asked, so it's not necessarily true that the husband can get out of it whenever he wants to? Question about that?
Yeah, on the last part about the chapter. So but how can it be we know that Aldal would have...
Okay, so now you're asking from the other half of the equation. Right, sorry? Yeah, no, you're also asking about if I said that, I was wondering whether, I wasn't sure if I was going to get into this.
Yeah, so, it seems like Paulina Dibure.
Right, so not necessarily. So I think there's two answers to that question. So basically what Noah's question is, I just said a second ago, that Cherem could mean that it was always Aser, and just they basically made a big deal about it. And we're talking here about Mimigarish and Mishal Bal Korcha. So Noah's question is, what about the other half? The other half is you can't take an extra wife. So don't we know that's clearly Matim and Hatavah? The Avos did it. So I think there's two answers to that. One is that not all Charamim are equal. In which case, the very important part that comes out of that is that you can't look at a Charam and say, well, if there's a Charam, that means Menatari was Mutter. Because maybe a Charam might be something new, or it might be an enforcement of an existing policy. This comes up, for example, in copyright law, because there's a Charam of the Rabbanim not to publish somebody else's work without their permission. So there are those who say, okay, it's a chayru, it means that until now it was mutter, that there's no actual dinna Torah stopping you from that. So I'm not so sure how compelling that is. It could be that this, either all charamim or certain charamim are cases where something was wrong and just people were not properly acknowledging that it was wrong and behaving as if it was mutter. So the rabbinic authorities of those times made a big deal about it and instituted an official communal sanction. But it doesn't mean that before that it was okay to do. Now, but the second approach, it gets a little more complex, is that the idea that it was mutter to marry one wife. So there's two issues involved in marrying a wife, marrying an additional wife. One is Eben Ezer, one is whether it's considered to be adulterous in family law, and the other is Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, that if your wife doesn't want you, your wife assumes she's entering into a faithful one-on-one relationship, so then for you to take another wife is a terrible slap in the face, Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. So theoretically, in a society where it's not expected the husband's only going to have one wife, and there's no Ben Adam L'Chaveiro problem in having an extra wife, so then, okay, Menat Torah, it's mutter. But in a society where the expectation is that it's one man, one woman relationship, there's no extra wives, so then it's a tremendous avera ben adam l'chavero to take an extra wife. And therefore, Rabbeinu Gershom was saying, listen, guys, wake up. Okay, yes, it's true that Min HaTorah there was such a construct of having extra wives, but look around you. Every woman who gets married thinks she's going to be the only one. And for you to say, okay, even in that context, I can take another wife and I don't have to worry about how she feels. So he says, no, that's clearly on a Ben Adam L'Chaveiro level, completely inappropriate. And that's where he comes out with his position. So Yaakov and Leah, again, is not necessarily in a one-on-one environment, but also Yaakov and Leah was very bedieved, right? Now, it's not the only example of Lois having more than one wife, which is a bigger discussion, but it's hard to build on that as an example of what's supposed to be.
Yeah, so it seemed like she was assuming that it was just going to be her Yaakov. She didn't think that Rahel was the next.
I don't know if that's true. I don't know if there's any evidence that was necessarily the expectation.
Even though Freya, after they were already married, and Leah says, the Torah describes Leah as like emotions.
Doesn't Leah say to Rachel, like, I forgot the exact lashon, but doesn't she say, like, I was supposed to be me and Yaakov, but not you? Like, I think she,
Okay, so we'll check that. But again, I'm not even necessarily talking on the individual level. I think if you have a society where everybody in society, which may also explain why this is a cold in Ashkenaz rather than in Sfarad, living in a Christian society rather than in a Muslim society, so where everyone around you understands marriage to be one-on-one, so then to take on another wife, this is a tremendous slap in the face, but on l'chaver. So then the idea is that Rabbeinu Gershom said, okay, listen, you know, all of you who are saying, oh, I can take extra wives because the Torah allows it, so you're being clueless about the nature of the expectations in the world. And if you had any basic realization of what people think they're getting into, you'd realize that it's not right to take an extra wife. So that might be an example of what I mean, that it's not that it was mutter before that, that it was maybe a little more subtle, and you don't necessarily see it as an explicit pasuk in the Torah, but it was still always wrong, and you need the rabbinic authority to say, hey, people, wake up, stop relying on technicalities and saying, oh, I can't find the pasuk that prohibits this, and understand that it's always wrong. Another example like that is, he also was associated with the cherim on reading other people's mail. Right, so the point, until then, it was totally cool to just go into his mailboxes and read everything, and there was nothing wrong with that. So, no, it's not that that was totally cool, it's that maybe people didn't see, oh, where's it in the Chumash that says I can't read other people's mail? Oh, it must be okay. So, if you had common sense, you'd say, no, it's not okay, there's something clearly wrong with that. So, because people thought it was okay, because they couldn't find the pasuk that says it, so Rabbeinu Gershom is saying, let me spell it out for you. Okay, let me tell you that this is something we are not allowing. And not to say that, oh, until now it was great. It was to say that until now it was wrong, but people allowed themselves to not appreciate that. And Rabbeinu Gershom came and said, okay, if I have to be formal literal about it, I'll be formal literal about it. In any event, so this is a much bigger topic. I'm just mentioning it now because of this basic footnote, really. So the Taz raises this question, so should it be different nowadays? And he answers that when it comes to this situation, Rabbeinu Gershom wouldn't have been gozer, which you can understand. That to say that it's not right to marry somebody and then divorce her against her will, so maybe that's only true when you intentionally married her. But if you were forced into marriage in the first place, so then it makes sense that he wasn't gozer and that he wasn't addressing that. And the same kind of logic should say that, listen, if you want to divorce your wife against your will, when you enter into the relationship willingly, but if you enter into the relationship unwillingly, so then it's understandable that you should be able to exit in a unilateral fashion. Hi.
Why is it so concerned or reticent to just not, I can just say, afke'inu, and that Rabbeinu Gershom is upheld, we just do afke'inu.
So then that opens up a lot of other questions. So he's basically wondering where the scope of afke'inu applies to. And that, and the question of whether we can do afke'inu nowadays in our later generation. Right? So you, to say afke'inu at that point might be possible, but you're opening up a huge Pandora's box. Right? Because one thing to say that the Gemara says, this is the situation of afke'inu. But to say that 1,000 years later, or 500 years later, the Rabbanim of that time, the early Rishonim, would say that this would basically be concurrent with Chayim and Rabbeinu Gershom, a new level of afke'inu is a bigger chiddush. Not impossible, maybe impossible, maybe not, but it's definitely safer to say that we don't know that we need afke'inu and say that, okay, let him just divorce her and then we don't have to come on to that. Hi.
The Taz
says that, what about, if the whole premise is, we're worried about the woman because she's stuck, but we're not worried about the man because he's not stuck, but nowadays he is stuck. So he says, no, so in that case, Rabbeinu Gershom's chayrim wouldn't have applied. His chayrim wouldn't have applied, because it only applies to somebody who willingly marries a woman, so to then say, okay, you can just leave on your own without her consent, that's not right. But if she forced you into it in the first place, so then it doesn't follow that it would be wrong of you to exit on your own. Okay, so that's all addressing the question of the man from this perspective of whether there's an afke'inu or not. To assume that technically it works, right? Basically to assume that there's no difference between men and women as far as tzluhu, and we're looking at it just from the kinyanic perspective, and therefore the only question is, do we apply afke'inu to him also? But maybe that whole premise is wrong. Right, maybe there are differences. Maybe they're not seen the same way. So this is a question. So you saw the Rama in Simin Membeis in Ibn Ezer where he brought two dais about this. And it could be the two dais are about this question we just mentioned, whether the Afginu applies to the man or not. But it could be that it's more fundamental. So here's where we started talking about yesterday about the Rashba and the Bala Yitr. Right? The Rambam says that if you force a man to get married, then it is chal, isha not, but ish yes. And the Rashba says that the Bala Yitr is of a different opinion. The Bala Yitr is you cannot force a man to get married, and he himself, the Rashba, disagrees. And he sides with the Rambam. I think we mentioned yesterday that siding with the Rambam might only mean practically, but maybe not conceptually. Because we don't know where the Rambam's coming from. Whether he's coming from Baba Basra, and Dina Kinyanim, or he's coming from something else. But the Rashba is dealing with Baba Basra. He's dealing with Dina Kinyanim. So what issue is, according to the Rashba, really what is the core issue between him and the Bala Yitr? What's the main question that they're really fighting about? Yes, no?
The nature of Kinyanim by fusion?
Maybe, probably not. Because that could be the issue here. Except, it's pretty explicit in the Rashba and the Bala Yitr what they're focusing on. So they're focusing on, it seems, that if we know, if you force someone to sell, the sale is good. What does that say about forcing someone to buy? And so if the ish is in the kona position here, the woman is in the selling position, so okay, we apply to her the concept of someone who's forced to sell. But what's the status of somebody who's forced to buy? So we know that the Gemara says if you're forced to give a gift, so then that doesn't count. Right? Because we need some reason to believe that you ultimately reconcile to this. So if someone forces you to give a gift, how do we know that you ever came to grips with this? How do we know that you ever decided to be okay with this? There's no upside for you. If you sell something, okay, so you get money, so maybe ultimately you came to grips with it and you said, okay, I'm giving you this item, I'm getting paid. Right, and again, maybe you saw some sources about this. This is all separate from the question of whether this is mutter to do. This is very likely against one of the Ten Commandments. But that isser aside, it would still be effective in the end. So does that logic apply equally to the purchaser? So the Bala Yitr says, no, the purchaser, if you force someone to purchase something, the purchase does not work. And this is explicitly the issue, because this is what the Rashba quotes him as saying here. And also the Ramah, I think I put this on the list, right? The Ramah in Choshen Mishpat in Reish Hay, right? I put that list, the Ramah quotes over there. He quotes the Bala Yitr again, just not talking about Kiddushin, just on the subject of forced purchases. And there he quotes the Bala Yitr as saying, if you're forced to buy something, that doesn't work. The whole discussion that's in it is about being forced to sell something, but being forced to buy something doesn't work. And the Rashba himself disagrees. The Rashba himself says, no, it's all the same. In fact, let's go the other way. Let's say that if being forced to sell works, then being forced to buy for sure works. They're definitely the same, and even more so. So, what's this whole machlokas about? What differences could you find? Why would you say, you have a transaction, right? And the Gemara Svara ultimately is that because you give something and you get something, even if you didn't want to, ultimately, you came to terms with it. So, if that's true for the seller, why shouldn't it be true for the buyer? What's the Bala Yitr complaining about?
Maybe kesef for das is different than just any other object.
Okay, explain.
That when you everyone is happy with money, everyone's happy with getting kesef, even, and that would be an affirmation of the consent of the dots that, okay, I actually did want to give this item up rather than get money for it. But if you quit getting and purchasing, though, that might be kind of, that's might be a lot more subjective.
Okay, so that actually is a good point. That is actually what the Kesef says. No, I said that type of what the Nesivus says. The Nesivus argues on Mitzos, which we'll explain in a second. Right? So, because the Mitzos and Nesivus is in their contract, they have to disagree about everything. So, the Hesber of the Nesivus, the Simon Tess, and the Choshen Mishpat, is pretty much along the lines of what you just said. That money is fungible, it's fluid, it can be used for anything, it can be moved around. So, it's safe to say that once we actually do the transaction, and I give you this desk for money, okay, at the end of the day, I'm happy. I have money that I could buy another desk, I have money that could buy something else, I could buy an upgrade on my desk, I could take a trip and forget about my desk, I could, whatever it is, money is going to make me happy in the end. But to go the other direction, to take that money, which could have bought anything, and now narrow it down just to being the desk, that's only one of a million options of money you could have bought. So how do you know that's a valid approach? So that's essentially the view of the Nesivus. So the Kesos says a little bit differently. The Kesos has a discussion in Simon Tess where he is mostly in line with what he says in the Avnei Miluim over here in Membeis. Right? Membeis is where the soul of Simon and Avnei Ezer is about being forced to get married, so he has a discussion, the Avnei Miluim, and they're mostly in sync with each other. So you might think that's obvious. I've heard some comment that, oh, you know, they make fun of somebody who says, oh, the Avnei Miluim agrees with Iksos because they're the same author. But it's not as obvious as it sounds, just, you know, as much as you might want to make fun of somebody for saying that. But it's not as obvious as it sounds, because first of all, if I'm not mistaken, the Avnei Miluim was published posthumously by his family members, and it's a slightly different style. It doesn't always line up perfectly. And there are sometimes contradictions, so as funny as that may sound. And in this particular lineup, Membeis and the Avnei Miluim and Kesos and Simon Tess, there is a point of difference. We won't necessarily get to it today, but if you look in the fancier editions, the footnotes, you look in the fancy footnotes in the Avnei Miluim and the fancy footnotes in the Kesos, they'll all point out that there is a slight discrepancy between the position of the author in those two places, which I don't have quantitatively explained, maybe we'll mention it later. But so it's not a given that they will always say the exact same thing, even though they're the same machaber. But, you know, the Kesos' other famous sefer was the Sheiv Shmeisa. The Sheiv, if you're familiar with the Sheiv Shmeisa, the Sheiv Shmeisa was supposedly written when he was 17. And all the Rashi Yeshivas always say that if he wrote it when he was 17, at least you could read it when you're 17, which is still pretty daunting. But I think he must have revised it later, because, for example, he quotes his son in the Sheikh Shmaisa. So if he was impressive writing this at 17, his son must have really been able to. I don't know what kind of an advanced prodigy he was. But I think there are indications that he came back and added to it. But it's impressive nonetheless. But that basically means that the Sheikh Shmaisa, you know, is an earlier work when he was a teenager, and the Kesos is his mature work, and the Avnei Miluim was his posthumously printed work. There could be differences. But in any event, so the Avnei Miluim and the Kesos, so they basically understand something that's very important for us over here, that perhaps there is a different level of das that is necessary to sell something and to buy something. That selling something, he assumes, needs a lower level of das. And here's where we can get into all kinds of murky terminology, and that goes back to our point for the past 2 days about speaking English, in which these terms can sometimes be manipulated. But as far as talk about Ratzon and Ratzon Gomer, absolute Ratzon, weaker Ratzon, two levels of Ratzon, super Ratzon, and lesser Ratzon. Sounds like very Kabbalistic. You know, that's an Elyon, that's an attachment. So the assumption is that whatever terminology you want to use, that selling is a lower level of Ratzon than buying. And that selling, all we need to know is that in the end you consent. Okay, you took the money, you consented. And buying requires more. So he doesn't fully explain it, but I think that the Chiluk is based on the idea that the Gemara in Bava Basra mentions in the name of Rav Huna, that, and I don't think I actually included this phrase in the Gemara in Marma Kama, look at the sugya in its totality, so you'll see this over there also in Bava Basra, that one reason to say that if you're forced to sell something, the sale is good. It's a combination of points. One point is, yes, at the end of the day, you accepted the money. So you at least have some compensation. But there's another point, which the Gemara mentions over there in Bava Basra, that maybe we should say that every sale is coerced. Every time anyone sells something, it's under coercion. What does that mean?
Never mind.
Well, what might that mean? Why would I say that every sale is under coercion? Is that
a diet? I guess there's a part of you that wants to keep the object that you have.
Okay, so why are you selling it?
Because you want to do the deal, you want to get money. But
you want money, right? Yeah. So that's the thing. So everybody really would like to hold on to all their stuff, but they also need money. So, at the end of the day, and we all know situations where this happens, especially here as students at Yeshiva University, right? So we know about that happening really as something you're doing because you need money. Maybe you wouldn't otherwise sell something, but you need the money. So we could say, that's what this statement of the Gemara reflects, that all sales come from need. Anytime somebody sells something, they'd really rather probably hold on to it for a rainy day. But the money is something they need more urgently. So they overcome their desire to hold on to their property and they sell. So once that's true, if every sale is already under duress, so then we add a little more duress, it's not radically different. It's just a question of where on the spectrum, how duress is it? Everybody basically who sells something is selling against his will, and at the end of the day he agrees to do it. Right? You'll never be able to come to court and say, I want it back when I sold this guy because I only sold it because I need the money. Because we know that at the end of the day that's still considered free will. But the pressure of the economic need is still what pushed you to do it. So maybe it's just a question of degree. If somebody is exerting some other kind of pressure on you, and at the end of the day you take the money, it's not radically different. But we don't really have a model like that for Kenyan, for the other side of the Kenyan rather, for somebody who's being Conan, for somebody who's acquiring. We don't really have a model like that where somebody buys something he doesn't really want to buy just because he's forced to. Now, that's not totally true. There are individual situations where that's the case. And you buy medicine because you really need the medicine. But that only is going to work if it happens to be something that fits in the category. We can't make that happen with any random item. Right? So if I force you to buy this desk, there's no svara that says, well, you know, you were kind of being forced to buy the desk anyway. So, therefore, perhaps that's the reason why the Bala Yitr's position is that you don't find the same flipping over to the position of the Kohen. So now the question is, so where does Kedushin fit into that? So the Avnei Miluim himself takes the position that you should say, okay, so this is all only true when we're talking about buyers and sellers of merchandise, but maybe Kedushin, you don't have this whole story. And he phrases it in an interesting way, in a way that's very arguable, and indeed one might argue, that since, he says, as we've been saying all along from day one, since Kiddushin is not a normal Kenyan where you're actually acquiring something, and like most of the Rishonim that we pointed to again from day one, that Haisha Ein Gufa Karnavi, that she is not actually sold, and he points to some of these Rishonim that we mentioned on day one that make that point. So therefore, this whole logic of when you say there's a Mechira Bal Korcha, when you say there's a Kenyan Bal Korcha, doesn't really apply. And maybe all we need is just some indication of Hesken, some indication of agreement, and therefore maybe it would work even in the situation of Korah. Now you see how that last point is very arguable, right? You say, okay, I can hear there's a difference between Kiddushin and normal Kinyanim, but the question is, what way does that difference cut? To say that you need that it's more susceptible to coercion, that's perhaps a little bit of an arguable point, and others do. But just parenthetically, it's interesting to see here that here the Avin Eluim is emphasizing the view, again, that we've been saying, that the Isha is not herself sold, which is just important to keep in mind, because the Avin Eluim earlier we mentioned that it's going to be a question, that he says that Kesef Kiddushin is Kesef Shiva. So you see, even he who's the most extreme about that still acknowledges that she herself is not purchased, so they have to understand differently whatever he means when he says it's Kesef Shiva. Question. Your unasked question is well taken. So, one could say that the Shiluk is true, and yet the logic goes a different way. And so, for example, the Primoshe wants to suggest, and we'll just try to say this before we run out of time, and then we'll see tomorrow we'll do the Parsha. Maybe we'll add a few more words about this, but either way, this takes us to a certain point. That maybe the whole point of Rashi of Halcha V'Haisa, the Rashi of Midaita, is maybe coming to tell you that he disagrees with the Ran. You recall, we mentioned yesterday, and several times the Ran in Nedarim, that the Isha doesn't do anything in the process of Kiddushin, she just agrees. So maybe Rashi disagrees with that. Maybe Rashi says it's not just Heskim that's required, but maybe there's actual Das that's necessary. And she has to actually be willing, and that's unopposed. And maybe that's why we need a Pasuk to tell you, Midaita, when she actually got up and went to some other man. Because you could have thought, and maybe just from Halachos of Kinyanim, you could have indeed thought this, that just agreement is enough. Because you're being forced to sell something, agreement might indeed just be enough. So maybe the point of this drasha of Rashi's in Yevamos and elsewhere in the Smag is to say that no, for Kiddushin, we need more. And he notes, and I guess we'll just mention this point before breaking into Mincha, that if you look at the Rambam, and it's the Rambam in Dalet Aleph, about forcing a man to get married. So here the Ravid says, Kasav HaRavid, yeah, you can force a man to get married, Vahushi Yomer Rotsani. But he still has to say, I want to. In other words, the Rambam forgot that point in the Ravid's mind. So the Lecha Mishnah asks on this, unless the Caleb in general pick up the point, that when the Rambam discusses the same halacha in Hilchos Mechira, that you can force someone to buy something. So there, the Ravid doesn't pipe up with, you have to say, road sign. So the point could be that they're different. That maybe selling something, indeed, doesn't really require actual rutzon, just requires agreement. While Nisuin, Kiddushin and Nisuin, requires something more, requires actual ratzon. So the Rambam says forcing the woman is not going to work with Lal, and forcing the man is only going to work if he says ratzon, or at least that the Ravid's reading of the Rambam. That the Ravid's agreeing with the Rambam on the other points that forcing the woman is not going to work at all, but forcing the man, meaning ratzon, because he sees the difference. This is not the same as Hilchos Kinyanim. And it only has this external similarity, but other than that, there is a pretty key difference in terms of the level of that. Okay, so that covers some important points. again. So we'll stop here for today. Tomorrow, again, we'll start with Shishu of Nitzavim. For some time, maybe we'll end up saying a few more words about the Sugya, but again, other than that, that is our Kedushin for before Yontif, starting next week. So we're back here on Wednesday and Thursday. So we'll do Yontif topics, Parsha topics, simple things like that. And after Sukkot, we'll pick up with Yontif. Alright, we wish everyone a wonderful day. We'll be looking forward to seeing everyone tomorrow. And that's short.